Is this on?
Yes. Right. Good afternoon. I'm Nishi Shah. I'm the chair of the Amherst College Philosophy Department. And before we begin, a student, Andy Werner, has an announcement to make.
So tonight we're having the weekly meeting of the Amherst Philosophy Club. So to the students among you, at 8 p.m. in the bottom floor of Cohen Dormitory, we're going to meet and talk about the lecture that we're going to hear today. So all of you are welcome. There's snacks, and hope to see you there.
So welcome to the fifth annual Amherst Lecture in Philosophy, which has generously been funded by John Forey and Carol Mickett. The Amherst Lecture is published online at amherstlecture.org. So it's a pleasure and an honor to introduce this year's speaker, Professor Christine Korsgaard. Professor Korsgaard is professor of philosophy and director of graduate studies of philosophy at Harvard University, where she's taught since 1991. Before coming to Harvard, Professor Korsgaard taught at Yale, the University of California at Santa Barbara, and the University of Chicago, as well as holding visiting positions at UCLA and Berkeley. Among her many honors and awards, she's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and has received the Mellon Distinguished Achievement Award. She's author of two books, The Sources of Normativity and Self-Constitution, as well as two collections of essays, Creating the Kingdom of Ends and The Constitution of Agency. Professor Korsgaard has done groundbreaking work on the most fundamental issues in moral philosophy, including the nature of practical reason and practical agency, moral obligation, personal identity, normativity, and more recently, the ethical relations between humans and other animals. Her first book, The Sources of Normativity, is arguably the most important book in moral philosophy since John Rawls' A Theory of Justice. While many works in moral philosophy are surprisingly dry, The Sources of Normativity, as well as her other work, is not just profound, but riveting. Well, don't take my word for it. Hear for yourself. Today, Professor Korsgaard is going to share with us her reflections on the evolution of morality. Please join me in welcoming Professor Korsgaard.
Thank you for coming to a lecture on what is, after all, apparently the second day of summer. I know you must have been tempted elsewhere. I hope you all have a copy of the handout and that you have two different pages. I won't be referring to the handout as I go along, but you'll find you'll be able to follow the main points of the talk by looking at the handout. Now, in recent years, there's been a fair amount of speculation about the evolution of morality among scientists and philosophers alike. From both points of view, the question how our moral nature might have evolved is interesting because morality is one of the traditional candidates for a distinctively human attribute, something that makes us different from the other animals. From a scientific point of view, it matters whether there are any such attributes because of the special burden they seem to place on the theory of evolution. Beginning with Darwin's own efforts in The Descent of Man, defenders of the theory of evolution have tried to show either that there are no genuinely distinctive human attributes, that is, that any differences between human beings and the other animals are matters of degree, or that apparently distinctive human attributes can be explained in terms of the interaction between other attributes, which are themselves matters of degree. Darwin's own account of the evolution of morality, which I will be discussing later on, is of this second kind. Now, from a philosophical point of view, of course, understanding the ways in which we're different from the other animals is one way of understanding ourselves. And although it's a little obscure exactly how it works, one of the traditional modes of philosophical understanding, especially of morality, is the origin story. Think, for instance, of the accounts of morality we find in Hobbes or Nietzsche or Rousseau. All of these thinkers try to throw light on what it means to be human by telling us stories about how moral motives, emotions, or even obligations themselves might have emerged from events or processes that are envisioned as historical. So it's natural to think that an evolutionary account of morality might somehow throw light on the phenomenon itself. Now, I'm tempted by that possibility, but just for that reason, I'm dissatisfied with some recent biological accounts of the evolution of morality. In section one of the paper, I'll explain why I think there's a problem with these accounts, but I can sum it up easily. Basically, the problem is that I think it's unclear how they can explain the emergence of what I call normative self-government, the capacity to be motivated to do something by the thought that you ought to do it. In section two, I'll explore some solutions to that problem that have emerged from the sentimentalist tradition in moral philosophy, including Darwin's own solution, which drew on that tradition. And I'll explain why I think those solutions also don't work. My own account of morality is, in a sense, intended to address the problem, but in section three, I'll explain why it might seem to leave the difficulty in place. Finally, in section four, I'll draw on an earlier tradition of theorizing about the evolution of morality to suggest a possible origin story of my own. Many of the traditional candidates for the distinctively human attribute seem to have given way to recent discoveries or rediscoveries about the other animals. Animal scientists have established that many of the other animals acquire much of their know-how through learning rather than innate instinct, that some of the other animals use and manufacture tools, that some of them have local traditions concerning what to eat, how to prepare it, and how to medicate themselves, and so on, and that a few can be taught some of the basic elements of language. So it's not surprising that scientists have also gone looking for the rudiments of morality in our non-human relatives and have claimed to find such rudiments in the evidence of the tendencies to altruism, cooperation, empathy, or reconciliatory behavior that can be observed among some of the social animals. The research supporting these kinds of claims has met with a degree of controversy that we might find a little puzzling. Of course, it's not surprising that those who reject the theory of evolution should dispute them, but it may seem surprising that scientists themselves, who presumably accept that theory, should still sometimes hotly contend for the uniquely human character of some of these attributes. Those who teach the other animals to communicate linguistically, for example, may be met with the claim that what the animal learns is not really language until the syntax reaches a certain level of complexity. By raising the standards for what counts as having a certain attribute, we can perhaps preserve its human distinctiveness, but what's the point of the exercise? And it's not uncommon for those who wish to defend our continuity with the other animals to speculate that there is some lingering piece of pride or ego at work in these controversies, something that makes human beings want to believe that we're unique among the animals. Now, I'm sympathetic to that worry, and yet I must also confess that I'm inclined to believe that something that I want to call reason, one of whose manifestations is something that I call morality, is a distinctively human attribute, and one that might explain quite a lot about what seems to be so different about human beings. But it is important to be clear about what I mean by reason here and about its implications for the question of evolution. The primatologist Franz de Waal, in his book Primates and Philosophers, distinguishes two schools of thought about morality. According to one of them, he tells us, morality is, and I'm quoting, a cultural innovation achieved by our species alone, where this is supposed to imply that, quoting again, our ancestors became moral by choice. The other, his own theory, views morality as a direct outgrowth of the social instincts we share with the other animals. De Waal associates the two views loosely with the rationalist and sentimentalist traditions in moral philosophy and suggests that according to proponents of the rationalist view, morality is not something about which it's appropriate to tell an evolutionary story at all. Now, in fact, I know of no philosophical view according to which human beings became moral by choice, as De Waal puts it. But we might take De Waal's description of the rationalist position as a rough characterization of the sort of neo-Hobbesian or contractarian view according to which morality is founded on something like a social contract, entered into for reasons of self-interest. Such views take it for granted that reason is the standard of doing what's in your own best interests, and argue that morality is rational in the sense that it promotes those interests. When I talk about morality being a manifestation of reason, I'm not talking about that sort of thing, but rather about views according to which moral laws are themselves principles of reason, such as rational intuitionist views, or Kant's view that the categorical imperative is a principle of reason. And I do think that reason, in the sense that supports those theories, is something that must have evolved. So when I suggest that morality is a manifestation of reason, I don't mean to suggest that there is no evolutionary story to tell about its origins. But I do mean to register one source of my dissatisfaction with some of the current attempts to trace the evolution of morality, which is that I think that what they're trying to explain, which is characteristically altruism, cooperation, sharing, and things of that kind, is not quite the thing that needs to be explained. Morality, as treated in these kinds of accounts, is defined by its characteristic content, which has something to do with, say, social relationships which take the interests of others into account. Mark Bickoff and Jessica Pierce, in their book Wild Justice, say, for example, "We define morality as a suite of other regarding behaviors that cultivate and regulate complex interactions within social groups." And De Waal himself, in Primates and Philosophers, claims that the essence of human morality is taking the interests of the entire community into account. In the discussion following the lectures that make up that book, at which I was present, De Waal remarked that he regarded morality as a system of conflict resolution. Now, to someone working in the philosophical tradition of Plato, Aristotle, and Kant, or for that matter, as we'll see, of Hume and Adam Smith, the characterization of morality as a system of conflict resolution, or a tendency even to good social behavior, is bound to sound a little thin. These philosophers, or so I want to protest, had something rather grander in mind. They were talking about what they took to be our unique human capacity to take responsibility for ourselves, to give shape and form to our own identities or characters, and to make laws for our own conduct. They were talking not just about a relation in which we stand to others, but about a relation in which we stand to ourselves, a relation which does not seem very tempting to attribute to any of the other animals. Morality, so regarded, is one manifestation of the human capacity for what I'm calling normative self-government. That is, human beings have the capacity to assess the potential grounds of our beliefs and actions, to ask whether they constitute good reasons, and to regulate our beliefs and actions accordingly. In the theoretical realm, the capacity for normative self-government is expressed in the deliberate construction of systems of belief, employing consciously held standards of good evidence and valid argument. In the practical realm, it is expressed most obviously in the capacity to act from what we familiarly call a sense of obligation, grounded in consciously held principles of good or right action. I think that the human capacity for normative self-government, and not just good social behavior, is the thing whose evolution needs to be explained. Now, of course, everyone involved in these discussions grants that morality is not merely a tendency to good social behavior. If altruistic and cooperative behavior were the essence of morality, the ants and the bees would be our moral heroes, and no one supposes that they are. And everyone also agrees that what these thinkers call human morality plainly involves something over and above altruistic or cooperative dispositions, some cognitive element, such as the ability to follow explicit articulated rules, or the self-conscious use of moral concepts, or the related capacity to make and be motivated by moral judgments. But explaining how that capacity arose is not usually part of the biologist's enterprise. In my own commentary on De Waal and Primates and Philosophers, I claimed that the essence of morality rests in normative self-government rather than in altruism or cooperation. Beckhoff and Pierce, commenting in part on my remarks, say that they regard such matters as being motivated by conscious moral judgments as relatively late additions to the suite of moral behaviors. And De Waal himself, in his response to the commentaries, suggested that the human capacity for internal dialogue, quote, lifts moral behavior to a level of abstraction and self-reflection unheard of before our species entered the evolutionary scene. Now, I don't know exactly what these authors have in mind in making these remarks, but the remarks may suggest the idea that what's distinctive about what they call human morality is the result of adding some kind of advanced intellectual faculties onto sociable instincts or desires. But exactly which advanced intellectual faculties are supposed to be involved and how adding them to social instincts is supposed to produce a normatively self-governing animal is left rather vague. So something more surely needs to be said. Now, unlike many of his more recent followers, Darwin himself did attempt to fill in this gap. Darwin took a keen interest in the sentimentalist tradition of moral philosophy that gave rise to the utilitarian theory that was dominant in his own day. No doubt this was partly because of the time and place in which he lived, but I think it was also because philosophers in the sentimentalist tradition had tried to give an answer to the question how the sense of obligation might be something that human beings acquired. David Hume gives us one picture of how that might be. Leaving aside a complication about what Hume calls the artificial virtues, Hume thinks that moral standards are the result of our approving and disapproving of motives that we already naturally have. Approval and disapproval are themselves sentiments, but they require advanced intellectual faculties for two reasons. First, as Hume himself emphasized, they arise only when we look at things from an impartial perspective that we must use reasoning to achieve. And second, they require what contemporary ethologists call theory of mind, an awareness that people and animals have mental states, including motives, since motives are the main objects of approval and disapproval in Hume's theory. Now, in Hume's account, approval and disapproval are not in themselves motives. They're sentiments we feel about motives, our own and other people's. But Hume has a pretty good story about how it's possible for us to be motivated by the standards we form as a result of our approvals and disapprovals, how it's possible for us to be motivated by thoughts about what we ought to do. Approval and disapproval are, according to Hume, forms of love and hate, a kind of disinterested love and hate that we feel when we view things from an impartial standpoint, not governed by our own self-interest. These feelings of disinterested love and hate arise because we sympathize with the victims and beneficiaries of an agent's conduct and love or hate the agent accordingly. So to know that you're an object of the disapproval of others is to see yourself as the object of their hatred. And since our natural sympathy with other people induces us to enter into what we suppose to be their feelings, it induces us to enter into this hatred against ourselves. This motivates us to conform to moral standards. We wish to be lovable in the eyes of others because we wish to be lovable in our own. Now, just to make sure I haven't confused you here, let me emphasize that sympathy is playing a double role in Hume's theory. Impartial sympathy with the victims and beneficiaries of actions determines what we approve and disapprove of. And then sympathy with the approval and disapproval of imagined moral judges then motivates us to act in ways that we ourselves approve of so that we can be lovable in our own eyes. Now, of course, one might complain that this theory does not really imply that, strictly speaking, we're motivated to do what we ought to do simply by the judgment that we ought to do it. Rather, it implies that we're motivated to do what we ought to do because that is a way of avoiding self-hatred. That there's a problem shows up in this fact. The same mechanism that motivates us to do what we ourselves approve of would motivate us to avoid the disapproval of others, even if we thought that their disapproval was ill-founded. Sympathy, as Hume understands it, tends to make us hate ourselves if we think others either do or would hate us, regardless of the causes of their hate. Now, Adam Smith modified this story in several ways, two of which are important for our purposes. Hume thought of approval and disapproval as forms of love and hate based on sympathy with the victims and beneficiaries of the conduct of the person who is morally judged. Smith, on the other hand, thought of approval itself as a form of sympathy with the person judged. To disapprove of someone is to be out of sympathy with him. The other important modification is that Smith added a notion of what he called propriety. Hume thought that our approval and disapproval of motives is aroused by reflections on their utility and agreeableness. We approve of beneficence, say, because it's useful to those to whom the beneficent person offers assistance, and we sympathize with them. Smith argued that we also approve and disapprove of motives and the emotions on which they're based because of their suitability or proportionality to the objects that arouse them. We disapprove of the enraged person, say, because his anger seems out of proportion to the little annoyance that caused it, and this makes us unable to sympathize with him. Smith believed that strong emotional responses generally do seem disproportionate to those who are not in the grip of them, and therefore that the tendency of our natural desire to be in sympathy with others is to moderate and control our naturally violent responses. The person judged tones his responses down in order to win the sympathy of others. At the same time, the person making the judgment tries to imagine the situation more vividly in order to enter more fully into the person whom he's judging. The eventual compromise position reached, a level of response that puts the person judged and the person judging in sympathy with each other, is the proper response. These judgments of propriety give us the notion of a response being worthy of its object. We may say that the cause of someone's rage is not worth so strong a feeling. Now, importantly, we can make judgments of propriety about the sentiments of approval and disapproval themselves. So when we do something wrong, we may judge that it would be proper for others to disapprove or blame us if they knew. And when we judge that it would be proper for others to blame us, we are judging not merely that others would blame us if they knew, but that we are blameworthy. This appears to solve the difficulty with Hume's theory. We are only motivated to avoid conduct that we deem genuinely worthy of blame. Smith thought of such judgments as being rendered by what he called the man within, or the impartial spectator, a kind of internalized representative of the other, but one whose view of our motives is unimpeded and therefore reliable. When we're motivated to avoid the disapproval of the man within, it's as if we are in danger of falling out of sympathy with ourselves. Now, we know from his notebooks that Darwin studied this tradition of moral philosophy, and it seems clear that he was influenced by it when he came to produce his own account of the evolution of morality. Darwin argued that the evolution of morality could be explained through the interaction of two powers, advanced intellectual faculties and social instincts. As he says, I'm quoting, "Any animal whatever endowed with well-marked social instincts would inevitably acquire a moral sense or conscience as soon as its intellectual powers had become as well-developed or nearly as well-developed as in man." The developed intellectual powers in question, as we will see, turn out to be memory and theory of mind, an awareness of our own motives. Darwin's story turns on the difference between two kinds of instincts. There are social instincts, whose influence tends to be felt constantly by a social animal, and then there are the instincts associated with the appetites, whose felt influence is only occurrent, but when it does occur, stronger than that of the social instincts. It's an important feature of the appetites and the instincts associated with them that once they're satisfied, it's hard to recapture the sense of their force and urgency. So it's often the case that once we've satisfied an appetite, what we have done seems to us to not to have been worth it, especially if we've done it at the cost of satisfying some other desire or disobeying the call of some other instinct. Once our intellectual faculties have developed to the point where we can remember and reflect upon our motives, this difference between the two kinds of instincts has an important effect. Darwin explains it this way. Thus, as man cannot prevent old impressions continually passing through his mind, he will be compelled to compare the weaker impressions of, for instance, past hunger, or of vengeance satisfied, or danger avoided at the cost of other men, with the instinct of sympathy and goodwill to his fellows, which is still present and ever in some degree active in his mind. He will then feel in his imagination that a stronger instinct has yielded to one which now seems comparatively weak. And then that sense of dissatisfaction will inevitably be felt, with which man is endowed, like every other animal, in order that his instincts may be obeyed. According to Darwin, this satisfaction is regret or remorse, and its painful character eventually teaches us to control our appetites when they conflict with our social instincts. In addition, Darwin brings in, as it were, direct from Hume, the consideration that even if a man does not regret his bad conduct for its own sake, quote, he will be conscious that if his conduct were known to his fellows, it would meet with their disapprobation, and few are so destitute of sympathy as not to feel discomfort when this is realized. Now, of course, one might be inclined to protest, as I did against Hume, that this is not really doing what you ought to do because you ought to do it. We learn to conform to moral principles in order to avoid the uncomfortable feeling of regret or remorse. Smith, as we saw, tried to remedy the problem by adding a normative element to the negative emotion, the self-disapproval itself. It's not the sense that we will be blamed or that we would be blamed if others knew of our bad conduct, but rather the sense that our conduct is worthy of blame that motivates us to avoid it. Darwin, I think, is trying to capture this feature of Smith's theory in his own account by emphasizing the difference in the ways in which the two kinds of instincts affect us. Like Smith, he thinks that when we're not immediately in the grip of an appetite, it's hard to recapture the urgency we have when we are in its grip. So when we think about it later, it seems to us if it's not worth satisfying our appetites at the cost of the interests of others, and that looks like a normative thought. Nevertheless, I think Darwin's account does give rise to a problem similar to the one I noticed in Hume's. In Hume's theory, the problem is that the disapproval of others would motivate us even if it were not properly grounded in standards of right and wrong. In Darwin's theory, the parallel problem is that the difference between constantly and currently felt instincts would eventually teach us to conform to the constantly felt instincts, even if those were not the social instincts. After all, why in Darwin's theory are the constantly felt instincts the right ones to act on? Any instincts that were constant and steady in their influence would become authoritative over any instincts whose influence was occurrent, regardless of their content. Darwin is unable to appropriate Smith's idea successfully because of a problem in Smith's theory itself. Smith never really tells us exactly why the motives and responses with which others can sympathize are supposed to be the right ones to act on, or even why we should tend to think that they are. In the same way, Darwin has no story about why constantly felt instincts should be the right ones to act on. Now, of course, Darwin was not trying to produce a general normative or ethical theory. In fact, he was assuming a vaguely utilitarian framework, although he suggests that it's not the greatest happiness of the community, but rather something he called the greatest good or welfare of the community at which moral conduct aims. His account of this good or welfare has a distinctively biological ring. He says, "The term general good may be defined as the means by which the greatest possible number of individuals can be reared in full vigor and health with all their faculties perfect under the conditions to which they are exposed." It might seem easy enough to marry such an account of morality to an account of its evolution, but even if we accepted the moral view in question, the problem would still exist. It's not because the social instincts are constant and steady in their influence that it's wrong to ignore the interests of others in pursuit of the satisfaction of your own appetites. Now, of course, if you think that all morality is the way in which the social instincts express themselves in intellectually advanced animals, this point may elude you. But if you think there's more to the idea that an action is wrong than that it is unsociable, then the relation between Darwin's motivational story and the normative one is, after all, too accidental. Our capacity for moral motivation is a mechanism that just happens to favor the kind of conduct that Darwin considered moral. Now, these theories, born of the empiricist tradition of associationistic psychology, try to explain the origins of normative self-government by showing how some sort of pain gets attached to conduct independently identified as wrongful. One might complain that this couldn't give us a creature who's normatively self-governed. This could only give us a creature who's unsurprisingly governed by the desire to avoid pain. But I think it would be uncharitable to take these thinkers to be suggesting that the creature's goal is only to avoid pain. That's not the only role that pain can explain in the can play in the explanation of action. We should take them to be explaining in associationistic fashion how avoiding wrongdoing itself becomes a goal. So instead, I'll put my point this way. I think that these theories come very close to explaining moral motivation in the right way. If they were true, they would succeed in explaining the existence of creatures who inevitably find wrongdoing painful. And although I said that the conduct is independently identified as wrongful, I did not mean that the causes of the conduct's painfulness and the reasons for its wrongness are totally unrelated. In Hume's view, the fact that you disapprove of an action is what makes it wrong, and it's also what makes it painful for you to do it. Nevertheless, its being wrong is not what makes it painful for you to do it. Your desire to be lovable is what does that. And although Darwin doesn't tell us exactly how he arrives at his normative account of the good, I think we may say in a similar way that in Darwin's theory, the fact that conduct is against our social instincts is both what makes it wrong and what makes it painful. Nevertheless, it's not painful because it's wrong, but because of the way the social instincts express themselves, constantly rather than occurrently. But a normatively self-governed being is one who's motivated to avoid wrongful conduct because it's wrong. The motivation must be produced by the wrongness itself, not merely attached to it, even if it's non-accidentally attached to it. The reasons why the action are right or wrong must be the reasons why we do or avoid the action. So it looks as if nothing short of what Kant called pure practical reason can possibly do the job. Now, actually, I don't mean to make such a strong claim anyway on this occasion. My point is rather that whatever it is that makes some actions required and some wrong must be the source of our motivation for doing and avoiding them accordingly. And what makes some actions required or wrong is not merely their content, that they are altruistic or cooperative or sociable or whatever, but rather whatever it is that confers normativity on that content, whatever it is that makes it right to act cooperatively or altruistically or whatever. Kant certainly gives us one answer to that question. What makes an action right or wrong is determined by whether its maxim has the form of a law. And he claims that the moral motive, respect for law itself, is directly responsive to that consideration. But the more general point is that whatever confers a normative status on our actions, whatever makes them right or wrong, must also be what motivates us to do or avoid them accordingly, without any intervening mechanism. Now, this may seem to imply that we can't explain the evolution of morality until we have the correct moral theory, until we know what it is that actually makes our actions right or wrong. Among other things, that would mean giving up any hope that thinking about the evolution of morality could throw any light on morality itself. But I don't take the implication of what I've just said to be quite that strong. Rather, I take the implication to be that no account of the evolution of morality can be complete unless it includes an account of why we assign normative properties, rightness or wrongness, to our actions in the first place. That is to say, of why we think of our actions as the sort of thing that must be morally or rationally justified. And for this, we need to know what the problem is to which justification or the assignment of a normative status, right or wrong, is a response. Because an animal that's motivated to do or avoid certain actions, depending on whether or not they can be morally justified, must see himself as facing the problem of justifying his actions in the first place, and must be motivated to do what's right by the fact that it solves that problem. And most of the evolutionary theories on the table these days tell us little or nothing about what that problem is or why it arose. The other animals don't need to justify their actions. Why do we? Now, my own views are partly an attempt to address the question I just raised. In this section, however, I'll explain why it might seem as if they leave the situation in pretty much the same place that the sentimentalist views do. I'll start by being a little more specific about what I think reason is. A non-human animal, I believe, is guided through her environment by means of a representation of that environment that incorporates both perceptual information and appropriate desiderative or aversive responses. What I mean is that for the other animals, perceptual representation and desire and aversion are not strictly separate. The animal finds herself in a world that consists of things that are perceived directly as food or prey, as danger or predator, as potential mate, as child, that is to say, as things that are to be eaten, to be avoided, to be mated with, to be cared for, and so on. In this sense, we might say that the animal's perception has teleological content. The objects she perceives are marked out for her as being for certain things or calling for certain responses. I believe this because I think it's hard to see how perception could have been of any use to the relatively unintelligent animals in which it first evolved if something like this were not the case. Perception could not merely provide a simple animal with theoretical information on the basis of which the animal had to figure out what to do, so it must be that it tells the animal what to do. And if you feel tempted to say that no, it's instinct that tells the animal what to do, I will reply that I'm imagining that this is the form that instinct takes. But then it's important to add that the contrast I have in mind here is not between instinctive and learned. An animal might learn from experience that certain things are to be avoided, but if the form that learning takes is that she now simply sees them that way, her actions will still be instinctive in the sense I have in mind. Now, rational actions, as opposed to ones that are instinctive in this sense, involve a certain form of self-consciousness, namely consciousness of yourself as a subject, the subject of certain thoughts, desires, experiences, and so forth. I'll explain why I think this in a moment. But first we should ask, are human beings the only animals that are self-conscious in this sense? Some scientists believe that this form of self-consciousness is revealed by the ethologist's mirror test. In the mirror test, a scientist paints, say, a red spot on an animal's body and then puts the animal in front of the mirror. Given certain experimental controls, if the animal eventually reaches for the spot and tries to rub it off or looks away from the mirror towards that location on her body, we can take that as evidence that the animal recognizes herself in the mirror and is curious about what's happened to her. Apes, dolphins, and elephants have passed the mirror test, in some cases moving on to using the mirror to examine parts of their bodies that they can't ordinarily see, apparently with great interest. Other animals never recognize themselves and instead keep offering to fight with the image in the mirror or engage in some other form of social behavior with it. Now, it's a little difficult to articulate exactly why the mirror test is supposed to reveal an inner awareness of oneself as a subject. The animal grasps the relation between the image in the mirror and her own body. In so doing, she seems to show that she grasps the relationship between herself and her own body. For she grasps the relationship between two things, one of which is a certain physical body, and the other is, well, what? We can say and herself, but what exactly is the herself that she identifies with that body? Perhaps the idea is that what she identifies as herself is the self that is the subject of her own experiences. For instance, the one who sees the spot in the mirror, of whose existence she must then have some awareness. Interestingly, however, even if all that's right and shows that the animal knows herself as the subject of her experiences, it does not yet show that the animal must be aware of herself as the subject of her attitudes, that is, of her beliefs, emotions, and desires. And this suggests a possible division within this form of self-consciousness. An animal might be aware of her experiences and of herself as the subject of her experiences, and yet her attitudes might still be invisible to her because they are a kind of lens through which she views the world rather than being parts of the world that she views. In that case, she would still function in the way that I've called instinctive. The experiences that she was aware of having would still be experiences of things as to be eaten, to be fled, to be cared for, and so on. And her responses to those things would still be governed by the teleological content of her perception. But as rational beings, we are aware of our attitudes. We know of ourselves that we want certain things, that we fear certain things, that we love certain things, that we believe certain things, and so on. And we're also aware of the potential influence of our attitudes on what we decide to do. We're aware of the potential grounds of our actions, of the ways in which our attitudes incline us to respond. And once you're aware of the influence of a potential ground of action, you're in a position to ask yourself whether to allow yourself to be influenced in that way or not. As I've put it elsewhere, you now have a certain reflective distance from the impulse that's influencing you. And you're in a position to ask yourself, but should I be influenced in that way? You're now in a position to raise a normative question, a question about whether the action you find yourself inclined to perform is justified. Or so I've said in the past. And we might at first suppose that if something along these lines is right, it's easy to explain the evolution of the point of view from which normative problems arise. It's just a matter of a gradual increase in the scope of theory of mind, our grasp of our inner world expanding from knowledge of ourselves as subjects of our experiences to knowledge of ourselves as the subject of certain attitudes towards those experiences. But there are several problems with leaving it at that. The first problem is that even if self-consciousness about the grounds of our beliefs and actions makes it possible to raise normative questions, in the sense that it makes room for them, that fact by itself does not explain exactly why these questions arise for us or what kinds of questions they are. The second problem, which many of my own readers have pointed out to me in the past, is that it's not perfectly clear why just being conscious of the grounds of your beliefs and actions should be sufficient to put you, as it were, in normative control. It perhaps seems possible that we could be aware of a force operating on us mentally, but still be helpless in the face of it. So at this point, it might look as if my own account needs a supplement of just the sort of theory that the sentimentalists offered. We're aware of what goes on in our minds, and in particular, of the motivational forces at work on us. But now something must motivate us to take control of those forces and redirect them in accordance with normative standards. But I've already argued that such an account can't work. The trouble with this picture, I now believe, may be that it gets things the wrong way around. We're not able to take control of our mental attitudes because we're aware of them. Rather, I will suggest, our awareness of our mental attitudes is a product of our efforts to take control over what goes on in our minds. Now, before I explain what I have in mind, I want to remind you of an older line of thought about the evolution of morality, proposed in slightly different ways by Nietzsche in The Genealogy of Morals, and Freud in works like Civilization and Its Discontents and Totem and Taboo. Both of these thinkers were concerned in particular about the origin of guilt, and both suggested that guilt originated when an animal, who was not allowed to give expression to his aggressive instincts, turned those aggressive instincts against himself. Suffering from guilt is a way of hurting yourself, done for the sheer satisfaction of hurting someone when you need to hurt someone and are not allowed to. In Nietzsche's theory, guilt is continuous with the self-mutilating behavior, often observed in animals kept in cages, and for that matter, in unhappy human children. The originator of what Nietzsche called the bad conscience was, I'm quoting, the man who, from lack of external enemies and resistances, impatiently lacerated, persecuted, gnawed at, assaulted, and maltreated himself. This animal that rubbed itself raw on the bar of its cages as one tried to tame it. The details of why we had to turn our aggressive instincts inward are deliberately vague, and in my view, they don't much matter. In Nietzsche's story, stronger people, blonde beasts from the north, impose social forms on weaker people for purposes of their own. And it's these social forms that inhibit the expression of the aggressive instincts. In Freud's story, it is, of course, the omnipotent father who inhibits the expression of aggression in his child. Freud and Nietzsche wrote of turning aggression against your own instincts and punishing yourself for having them. But it seems to me that there's another possibility here, closely related to that, but not quite the same. Nowadays, scientists believe that versions of the dominance hierarchy are pervasive among social animals. When one animal dominates another, the subordinate animal gives way to the dominant one in competitive situations, as when they both want access to a certain bit of food or to a mate. Dominance is sometimes established by aggression and sometimes maintained that way, but not always. In some animals, dominance hierarchies are inherited and apparently go unchallenged for longish stretches of time. It appears that the evolutionary function of dominance may be to reduce the frequency of aggressive encounters in animal life. Now, I think that dominance is interesting in this context because dominance looks a lot like something we think of as essentially normative. It looks like authority. A dominated animal does something that he does not want to do or forgoes something that he would like to have, because he acknowledges something like the standing of another animal. It's not mere fear of the consequences. If you successfully dominate your dog, for instance, he's not afraid of you. He just recognizes that you're in charge and he's supposed to do what you tell him to. Now, I'm not interested in defending the details of these theories. What I want from them is the suggestion that the origin of morality might rest in the internalization of mechanisms of dominance and social control. That is, the suggestion that we began to become rational animals when we began as individuals to exert a kind of dominance over ourselves, to inhibit our own instinctive responses. I'm not going to speculate about exactly why this happened or why. Nietzsche and Freud make their stories sound like cataclysmic events in the lives of individuals. Somehow, that has to be translated into evolutionary terms. The important point for me now is that in Nietzsche's story, the internalization of the aggressive instincts is explicitly linked with a kind of deepening of consciousness itself. He writes, "All instincts that do not discharge themselves outwardly turn inward. This is what I call the internalization of man. Thus it was that man first developed what was later called his soul. The entire inner world, originally as thin as if it were stretched between two membranes, expanded and extended itself, acquiring depth, breadth, and height in the same measure as outward discharge was inhibited." What I want to suggest, following Nietzsche's lead, is that the consequence of this internalization was a new form of self-consciousness, which set us all together new kinds of problems of its own, namely normative problems. So now let me rephrase the suggestion from which I started. I suggested that normative self-government is not the result of our awareness of our own mental attitudes. Rather, our awareness of our own mental attitudes is the result of the control we began to assume over ourselves and our own responses. That way of putting it is right in a way, but it doesn't quite capture what I take to be the radical nature of Nietzsche's suggestion. It makes it sound as if our minds are stocked with a full panoply of mental attitudes, and that what internalization does is turn on the lights so we can see them. And that's not what Nietzsche says. What he says is that our minds acquired a depth, breadth, and so on, a dimension they lacked before, not one they had in the dark. So I take the suggestion to be that at least some of our mental attitudes are the products of the internalization, that our beliefs, desires, emotions, and so on are the result of the new form of consciousness that emerged. Now, I know what I'm saying sounds mysterious at this point. How could a form of consciousness produce its own objects in this way? Although, for that matter, of course, there is a way in which forms of consciousness do produce their own objects. Just think of sensory qualities. And the way I'm describing it also may make it sound as if I think animal minds are empty of mental attitudes, that they must lack mental states, and I don't think that. What I have in mind, rather, is that the things we identify as our attitudes, our beliefs, desires, and to some extent our emotions, are the products of the breakdown of the teleological consciousness that I have claimed must characterize the non-human mind. They're the result of our beginning to factor out and identify the ways in which we ourselves contribute to, and so are responsible for, the way the world is for us. Adam Smith can help us out here. He suggested that we would never think of our own minds if we were never exposed to other people. Contrary to what the privileged access view of the mind might lead you to suppose, we first spot mental attitudes in other people. From my own untutored point of view, I am not angry. I am simply the victim of an outrage, and that's the plain fact about the world. That's the teleological view of the world at work in me. The situation I'm confronting, I perceive as one that's to be defeated or something of that kind. But when I see you in that situation, when I'm not in the situation myself, I see that you are getting angry. There's a distancing use of mental attitude language. Was he in danger? Well, he believed that he was. Well, he was certainly frightened. A gap between the way the world seems to me and the way it seems to you appears to me at first as a distortion in the way it seems to you. So I conclude that something about you must be distorting the way it seems to you. If I'm a dominant animal, perhaps I see this as an occasion to inhibit your response. But when I begin to see occasion to inhibit my own responses, then I also begin to regard myself in the way that in Smith's story, I was regarding you. The identification of something as an attitude at work in me is a recognition that I am, or something about me is, making some sort of contribution to the way the world is for me. If being aware of a mental attitude, or more properly speaking, of the workings of your own mind, is essentially being aware of your own contribution to the way the world is for you, then as Kant said, our mental attitudes are always accompanied by an I think, I want, I intend. And from this recognition that our own mental activity is implicated in the way the world is for us, arises a new relation in which we stand to the world. When we begin to recognize the ways that conceptualizing, evaluating, and responding to the world are things that our minds do, that is, things that we do, then we begin to do them in a whole new way, self-consciously. And when we're, and then we're confronted with a new problem and a whole new set of questions, questions about what, if anything, counts as doing these things correctly. Is this a good ground for belief? Is this a good reason to act? Those are the questions of justification, questions that, so far as we can tell, only human beings ask. And when we begin to find answers to those questions, then the use of mental attitude language about ourselves no longer carries the implication of distortion. Instead, it carries the implication of normative commitment. Yes, this is what I believe. This is the right thing to do. To believe and act on the basis of such thoughts is to be a normatively self-governing animal. Okay, so I've suggested that the internalization of mechanisms of dominance and social control, the attempt to inhibit our own instinctive responses, was the first step in a process that led to a kind of general takeover or attempted takeover of our own mental lives. Mental states with an essentially normative dimension are the product of this takeover, factored out from the teleological consciousness when we begin to identify our own contribution to the way the world is for us. The recognition that our own mental activity contributes to the way the world is for us leads us to attempt to regulate that contribution, to get it right. And that is what leads to the formation of consciously held standards for constructing our own conception of the world and consciously held standards for determining our own actions. Those are the standards of reason which we then take to govern these activities. And that is how we become normatively self-governing animals. But now I want to conclude by bringing this all back home to the issue of morality. For perhaps you may feel that now I've only reversed the problem I started out from. I've got normative self-government on the table, but lost the connection with morality's characteristic moral characteristic content. Why, after all, according to this theory, should the kinds of conduct that we ordinarily call moral represent the correct solution to the problem of justifying our actions? In particular, why should altruism, cooperation, and fairness be a part of that solution? Well, in the absence of a particular theory of moral justification, which obviously I can't give you here, it's difficult to be specific. But I want to end by making a couple of suggestions about how we might get what we ordinarily think of moral content back on the table. Both suggestions turn on this fact, that the problem of justification arises for an animal for whom the teleological view of the world has broken down. The first point is this. Once we have reflective distance from the grounds of our attitudes and can ask whether we should act on them or not, we need a way of answering that question. To ask whether you should indeed flee from something that you perceive as to be fled, for instance, is in the first instance to ask whether it's really a threat, whether it can really harm you. But I say in the first instance because at this stage, we have not yet arrived at the fully practical question. At this stage, the practical question is still mainly instrumental, taking it for granted that, say, objects that can really do us harm are to be avoided, and only asking which objects those are. When we only think or reason instrumentally, we're still seeing the world through the lens of our own desires and interests. And to that extent, we're still seeing the world teleologically. But there's no reason to stop there. And there's a further question to be asked about when danger is worth facing or harm worth incurring and when it is not, not just instrumentally, but for its own sake. This is not just a question about how best to satisfy our interests, but a question about what our interests ought to be. In fact, it's the very question whose answer Smith and Darwin tried to build into their theories. So the breakdown of the teleological worldview of the non-rational animal means that we can no longer take it for granted that we should measure the world by our own interests, but instead must form an independent standard of what's worth doing for the sake of what. The second point is this. An essential part of overcoming the teleological worldview of the animal is recognizing that things don't exist in relation to me. The world does not, after all, consist of my predators, my prey, my offspring, and so on, but rather of beings with an independent existence of their own who happen to stand in those relations to me. Getting that fact firmly into view is essential to achieving a rational theoretical conception of the world, a conception of a world that exists independently of me and my practical interests. But it is also, intuitively speaking, essential to achieving the conception of the world that we nowadays recognize as practically rational, that is to say, as moral. That women do not exist to bear men's children and keep their houses, that strong young men are not fodder for older people's cannons, that people of color were not born to work in white people's fields, that the poor and ignorant do not exist that the rich may have servants, and that the other animals are not there for human beings to eat and to work for us and to submit to our experiments, that all of these beings do not exist for us and with reference simply to our interests, but have an independent existence and interests of their own. Grasping these facts is essential to forming a theoretical conception of the world that exists independently of us, as well as a practical conception of the world that we must relate ourselves to. So justification is not merely about how we can best satisfy our own interests, but is about what's worth doing and for the sake of what. And it must be responsive to the fact that there are many other beings who do not just exist for us or in relation to us, but independently of us and with interests of their own. If someday we can put those two thoughts together in just the right way, perhaps someday we ourselves will become the animals in whom morality has finally evolved. Thank you.
We'll have a short question period, and then we'll have a reception right outside this room afterwards. I'll take the questions, so if you want to ask a question, get my eye.
Got one quick question. Is it fair to summarize what you're saying? Man is purely moral because he has self-consciousness and has, and highly developed faculties for examining alternative courses of action and consequences in dealing with those factors outside of human herself.
The one thing I would add to that is just sort of specify the form of the highly developed, because it's not just like smarter. It's not because we're moral, because we're a lot smarter than the other animals. It's because in understanding, in grasping the fact that we have attitudes, like beliefs and desires, we're grasping the fact that we make a contribution to the way the world is for us, and then we think we can do that well or badly.
So we have responsibility.
That's the thing that makes it different, right.
Thank you. Hillary?
Yeah, I've got a question about your account of the difference between human and animal cognition. So there are some people, as you said, who want to see human cognition as animal cognition plus various other things, a language learning faculty, a theory of mind modules. But your suggestion was that there is something that they're different in kind, what you call this teleological conception. And if I understood it right, it's roughly like this. With humans, we've got beliefs and desires. The beliefs register various information about the world, and the desires are desires.
Right.
And the animals, instead of having these two separate kinds of states, have a single kind of state which combines the two.
Right.
Yeah, so I want to ask you just a little bit more about why you think for that. So, for example, you could have one and the same animal seeing one and the same object and sometimes wanting to use it for one purpose, or so it seems, sometimes wanting to use it for a different purpose. And it seems that it's got to pick up information about features of the object and decide what to do with it. Well, and do something with it. What it does is going to depend on this other kind of state, namely its desire. If external objects just prompted a single state which somehow combined belief and desire, then whenever you have the same external object, you'd always have the same kind of behavior in response to its presence. You don't see that.
Well, I take it the idea wouldn't just be that external objects prompted the state. The state the animal is in physiologically might also affect sort of which teleological perception the animal has of the object. So that a hungry animal might see. I actually, just to illustrate this, I saw a little slab of a nature show once in which the following event happened. A leopard attacked and ate a mother baboon. And while this was happening, the baby baboon slipped out of the grasp of the mother. And then the leopard, appetites being fully satisfied, had the standard sort of tending reaction to the baby baboon and took it up in the tree and slept with it.
Yeah.
You know, immediately after. It's like, when you're hungry, the baboon looks like food, but when you're not, it looks like a to be tended. You know, it's got big eyes, it's a baby. You take care, what you do is you take care of a baby, you know. So that's sort of the kind of thing I have in mind of priming, you know, having, affecting.
Okay, there's an utterly natural account of this where what you're calling a source of priming causes certain desires, and they interact with these independent beliefs. So I guess what I'm asking is, what reason is there for thinking that these things must get combined in the animals rather than that they lead to two separate kinds of states which interact to produce behavior just as they do in the animals?
Well, it's a little hard for me to say exactly why I think this, but
yeah.
I mean, when we sort of really work up our theoretical views, we have this sort of totally neutralized theoretical conception of the world around us as a thing, nothing to do with us at all, you know, matter in motion and unresponsive to our interests, the cold, cruel world. It seems hard for me to believe that animals have anything like that kind of conception of the world, a purely theoretical conception of what's out there. Maybe that's just reasserting my conviction rather than explaining it. But
Steve?
So Chris, in the story about the breakdown of teleological content, so what looks like it's doing the work. I mean, so were you giving Smith's account as just one example of how it might go, or did you mean to endorse that? I mean, I'm disposed to endorse it and say that really what's working there is the human capacity for empathy, which enables us to put ourselves in others' shoes. And once we're able to do that, then we're forced to this distinction. In sort of Smithian fashion. The other thing, so I was wondering what you thought about that possibility. The other thing I was wondering was the difference between normative governance, sort of Überhaupt, and what we might call morality, narrowly construed, or a sense of obligation, let's say, as opposed to a sense of the sensible or a sense of what would be advisable or what would be reasonable to do. And I'm wondering if, I mean, one way that could come in on Smith's picture, of course, is, so if I'm just seeing something, another animal or another person respond to something as though it were a danger, but I don't think it is when I factor it from my perspective, that'll just give me the sense that, well, that person's response is inappropriate or improper, but any sort of narrow moral judgment wouldn't come in. But once we get certain responses like, well, that's outrageous, then it looks like, well, something else is on the table by nature of the response in question. So I was just wondering how the story about normative governance in this context was meant to fit with the evolution of morality more narrowly conceived.
Okay, in response to your first question, this is I was really just thinking of the Smith. I was just giving that as an example of how teleological consciousness might start to break apart in the face of some interaction you had.
Right.
I wasn't advancing any general theory of such interaction. being in general the source of the breakdown. Since there is some evidence of empathy amongst at least chimps and gorillas, I think, not monkeys, but well, there's some among monkeys too, but there's others that refute it. But there is some evidence of among empathy among the other animals. I don't think empathy alone could be the source of the breakdown of the teleological consciousness. I don't know if that's what you were asking. As far as morality in the normative sense and more generally evaluative thinking or something like that, I wasn't really distinguishing them here, although I tend to be kind of a top-down thinker about this and to think that morality is the source of these other kinds of normativity. So I think we have some... we certainly have some natural... We have a sense of what's naturally good or bad, but I don't think that sense acquires any normative properties until we think about it morally. So, is there a third part of your question that I didn't answer because I kind of got a little lost?
No, but let's think about empathy for a second. So there's also this evidence that, you know, around autism, that kids who are not so good at placing themselves in people's perspectives likewise don't end up with mental states as well. And so I was just wondering if that wouldn't be a fairly plausible view about how the breakdown of teleological content actually happens. That is, once you've got this capacity selected for whatever reason, then it looks like you've got a being in whom you'd have that kind of breakdown.
Empathy could be a necessary, if not a sufficient, condition for recognizing attitudes.
I'm thinking about the cultural evolutionary question, and I'm interested in causality. And some of the things you were saying made me start to think about pre-village life for human beings versus village life. And the one thing I'd like you to comment on that I find interesting is that I'm an archaeologist. One of the things that we've noticed is that when people settled down, affinal groups came together, people not related, and therefore self-interest became diversified. And as a result of that, patterns of empathy, communication, and participation became much more complex. Now, in baboons, they have very complex social hierarchies, and so do chimpanzees. But the difference of degree is the numbers of human beings that started living in villages and pre-villages. Is it grew exponentially fast, and we know three things about that. We know that the standard of living dropped tremendously. Illness, animals, danger, all of those kinds of things, warfare, those all intensified self-interest diversification. The other two things have to do with the fact that people who didn't know each other were living together. And the third thing, of course, is that people were now looking at the environment in that way that you're thinking, the teleological way, which is we can use that and that and that because we're not going to go very far today. I was wondering if you could comment on that as being a crucible, if you will, for the matters of degrees of changes culturally and evolutionarily in this idea that people are developing empathy and then therefore some sense of other and morality as a result of it.
Well, one thing I'm certainly tempted by in your story is the idea that living with non-kin is an aid to rationality because you have to deal with people who are not obviously perceived as my offspring, you know, my friend, my enemy, you know, people who just have to be regarded as just another person. And that, since that's the kind of thought that I see as resulting from the breakdown of the teleological worldview, that seems... sort of to fit very well with the kind of thing I want to say.
Are there any students who'd like to ask questions?
At the part where you're describing how dominance has turned inward onto instincts, I'm wondering that, I'm looking at line on page 27, but when I begin to see occasion to inhibit my own responses, what exactly is it that bridges the gap between dominating others and turning that dominance in on yourself? Is it sympathy?
Um, I think what I had in mind in writing that passage, by saying that you'd internalize the dominance, is something like a point that an animal might reach sort of as a first step towards self-government, of, say, not doing something even when the dominant animal isn't there to stop him, just because he knows that the dominant animal wouldn't allow him to do it. That might be sort of the first primitive little I'm not supposed to thought. So something like that.
Sorry, Bill. Go ahead.
Okay. You seem to be making an assumption of moral monism. Consider a counterexample. Suppose there are two groups of people who have a history of enmity, and I'm a member of one of those groups, and someone from the other group murders my brother, or kills my brother. It's not even a murder, it's a political thing. Then, within my group, I might feel, and others might feel, that I have a duty to revenge that. At the same time, I might feel that I have a duty to take it to the legal system that covers both groups. And even in that case, or even suppose that I thought or knew that the legal system would not take care of it, I might also believe that I have a duty not to return evil for evil. So those are three sort of moral attitudes, even might be called three moralities, which are in conflict. And the border between my duty to take revenge and the other two could be described as my duty to be partial to my own group. I have a duty of partiality. I also feel the duty of impartiality. But these are conflicts between moralities, it seems to me. And when you talk about morality as being simply altruistic and a sense of what's right versus what's wrong, you're not taking into account the conflict of the pluralism of morality.
Okay, actually, I didn't get as far at all as saying how you would answer specific moral questions on the kind of account I was spelling out. I was only trying to get us to the point where we can understand why we ask them, why we think of our actions as the sort of thing that we might need reasons for and therefore have good reasons and bad reasons for.
Why do I ask questions of each of those situations?
Why you ask the questions in general? I mean, you've got people having conflicting stories about how to answer those questions. That's a kind of, that's something we argue out when we actually get to moral theorizing and see whether one of these accounts of morality is the correct one. But nothing I said in this paper was addressing that at all. I mean, I was just getting us to the point where, you know, human beings have these systems of justifying their actions, and why was that?
We have time for one more question.
Well, as a minor comment on dominance hierarchies, the notion that dominance hierarchies exist to minimize conflict, I always thought this sort of has the cart before the horse. Namely, the evolutionary view of it is that dominance hierarchies evolve out of the propensity of animals to squabble with one another for preferential access to food, mates, and meals. And that therefore, if anything, conflict, tension, fighting is an effect of that behavior of adaptation. It certainly is not a function. Say the dominance hierarchies have a function of minimizing conflict. It's got backwards.
It sounded to me like you said two opposite things, so I'm a little confused now. That at first you said dominance hierarchies arose out of the tendency of animals to squabble, and then you said it caused the tendency of animals to squabble.
Well, I mean, it's part and parcel of establishing dominance hierarchies. Individuals strive through finding conflict to be higher up, and then using preferential access to mates and food and mating's evident. And so to suggest that they exist in the first place to minimize conflict in the group as a whole, doesn't make any sense. If you want to minimize conflict in the group, you wouldn't have dominance hierarchies.
Well, you wouldn't have dominance hierarchies if you didn't have conflict. But I take it the theory is, this is not my own theory, I'm not a biologist, but I've encountered it in other places. The theory is something like this, that of course animals are going to compete for food and mates. We don't need to appeal to dominance to explain that. They're going to compete for food and mates because they need them. And the idea is that basically that dominance hierarchies sort of keep them from fighting to the death over these things all the time. The fact that one animal becomes the dominant animal and others respond by moving off means there isn't going to be a fight, and therefore there's going to be less aggressive encounters. Sometimes they do. Sometimes it's just a very ritualized battle, and no one's even hurt.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's food and refreshments outside. Please join us if you want to talk to Professor Grossgard even more.